Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Yeah, good. I see we're
Nice.
both in stripes, by the way. I
Oh
hadn't noticed
yeah.
that. There you go.
Yeah,
We're
oh
matching almost.
you got the
I
memo
picked it
about
up.
that.
Exactly. I'm totally prepared.
Brilliant, brilliant. Now, where are you coming in from?
I am in my office in Glasgow, having a very rainy, sunny day, half rain, half sun, the way it
Ah.
always is here.
Yeah, but it's a very cool city though.
Yeah, thank you. I think so too. I've been here almost 13 years now. It's great. It's great.
So where were you before?
Just immediately before, I was in Massachusetts for a year, but I was in New York for a good long time before that.
Right. Okay. I tell you, because I don't know much about your background. And maybe we'll reveal some things, but I mean that in the nicest way, of course.
Sure.
But I keep hearing a bit of Scottish and a bit of American, so now
No,
that kind of makes sense.
I know. I know. I just have no linguistic backbone, I think. So my sounds are all American, but I've taken on a bit of the Scottish lilt, you know. So da da
Ah.
da da. So I have the American sounds and the Scottish rhythm, if you like,
Yeah.
prosody.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
cool. That's cool. But I guess what that means is that you can kind of fit in and connect with different people by using your voice as an instrument.
That's it. I am apparently a bit of a chameleon. Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Yeah. Yeah. So people in America when they talk to you, do they go, "Oh, that sounds Scottish," and vice
They
versa, or?
laugh now. People that knew me before, like my family thinks they do sometimes just start laughing. And I don't realize what's happening until that it's become clear that it's my funny Glaswegian sing-song accent now. Yeah. But it's
Yeah.
nice. I like it. It's okay. It's okay. My children were born here, and they're very Scottish sounding. So I think that's still quite humorous to me. They sound more Scottish than even my husband, who's Glaswegian. I don't know how they've got it, but they have very thick Scottish brogues. It's very
Wow.
cute.
Wow,
Yeah.
that's cool. That's cool.
Are you from
Okay.
London, Richmond? I should know.
No. No,
No.
I'm not. I'm from Sussex originally, so down on the south coast.
Yeah.
So
My ear's
originally
not
from
good at
Hastings.
sound. Okay, good. But your practice is in London.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm up in London, but now I live down near Brighton.
Okay,
So sort of a long
lovely.
bit from Hastings. And yeah, because a lot of work's online these days, so actually it's quite nice to do a little bit of work from home. I'm fairly fluid, let's say. Some
That's
say
nice.
lazy.
I'm sure that's not true. You're doing things like this in addition to your practice. That
Yes,
doesn't sound lazy.
thank you for that.
It's
So
true.
anyway, well look, we're here together because I came across your work and it's really interesting, and I thought it'd be great to have a chat. And so I guess the start point really is to, well, how did you get into pain?
Yeah, so I was originally wanting to do international law. And in the States, they tell you to do an undergraduate in philosophy because you don't do an undergraduate in law there. And then I just fell in love with philosophy. So then when I went to graduate school, I was interested in everything. And pain was became a kind of focal point and an interesting thing to study because you had to, I think, to do it well, you had to do all these different aspects of philosophy. So that made it really attractive for me. And my way in was actually through ethics. So, a dominant theory in philosophy and philosophical ethics is that pain or pleasure is, the source of good and bad, and what's right is what, maximizes pleasure, and what's wrong is what, gives you more pain against pleasure. And so that made me want to know what pain was. And then here we are.
Yeah.
So,
Wow.
yeah.
Wow. I mean, wanting to know what pain is, I mean that's almost like the ultimate question, isn't it?
Well, it certainly was for me. Yeah. And I think, in starting to think about it originally from a philosophical angle, then I realized you know, it was a real practical problem, of course, and most centrally as a practical problem. And then it made me, it was a natural fit for me in some ways, because my father suffers from migraines. My mother is diagnosed fibromyalgia in the 90s. I had cluster headaches as a teenager. So it turned out I had all this sort of, you know, firsthand as well, sort of experience with sort of mysterious pains or pains that we can't treat or manage very well. And so that also then gave me a hook, I think, from a sort of practical, personal perspective too. So then it was like, you know, practical and theoretically interesting for me at the same time.
Yeah. So you reckon that kind of almost subconsciously, perhaps the experiences you were having and loved ones around you gravitated you towards that as an interest?
I mean, I definitely think that my personal experience with pain made me immediately skeptical of the overly simplistic theories, which I think sort of dominate the philosophical landscape, though happily that's beginning to change. Certainly for a long time, I think, not just in philosophy, to be fair, you know, in medicine too, there was sort of like a lot of really overly simplistic ideas about what it is and how to deal with it. And if you've ever sort of had to deal with it in ways that just obviously don't fit that model from the, you know, firsthand, first person perspective, you can see pretty quickly that they're problematic. So it's true. I think it probably played a role in that way. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely it, isn't it? As you're saying that, my inside is going, yeah. This very simple model that most people, if not everyone, perhaps initially is presented with to try and, was probably not even trying to explain their pain, but just to say this is kind of how it is. I guess you're talking about the biomedical approach and the sort of the search for structures and anatomy and pathology to explain an experience, and the fact that it just doesn't in so many cases.
Yeah. I mean, I think the tendency, I don't know how quickly or whether you want to go here, but I think the tendency to oversimplify goes even deeper than that. You know, at least the biomedical model tries to give you some components, even if it doesn't do great. But I think in philosophy, especially, you know, most philosophers, if you ask them, will say, well, pain is some particular feeling. And then, of course, we might have a more or less complicated model of what's going on in the body when you're having that one particular feeling. But the sort of starting point is that it's one particular qualitative state or one particular way of experiencing. And even that, I think, is overly simplistic. So I'm sort of alone in that controversial view. I think even philosophers with very sophisticated ideas about what's happening under the hood of pain, if you like, still almost all subscribe to the idea that it is a single sensation that all pains have in common. And then, of course, it's very hard to figure out what's going on and how to manipulate it and how many things might be involved in giving you that one distinct feeling. But I even don't think pain is always feels the same. I think different pains feel very differently. And sometimes you don't even more controversy, I think you can even have them and not feel them at all. So I think it's quite complicated, actually.
Mm. Oh my gosh, there's so much there. But just that last thing you said there about, you know, there can be pain, but you're not feeling it. Is that, am I right? What can you expand on that?
Feeling is a kind of strange word. So I think there can maybe be non-conscious pains or pains that you're not aware of the entire time that you're having them. So it took us a long time, I think, to think that way about perception or beliefs or desires. You sort of think pre-Freud or something, you know, the idea that we had beliefs and desires that we weren't aware of while we were having them was kind of a strange idea. But I think it's probably true just right across the board. And so also true for pain too, right? So maybe a pain wakes you up. It's a kind of example. You know, the pain, I think, is probably occurring or going on before you become aware of it. It sort of gets your attention to it. So that just means if things like that are true, one thing it means is that whatever pains are, they're not just a kind of experience, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes have them before you become aware of them.
Yeah, I think that's a really important insight, because lots of people will say, I wake up at night in pain, with pain, or they'll say it was my pain that woke me up. And exactly. I think I always find that really interesting, because it's kind of, that's a story, isn't it, that in a way that you're telling yourself, oh, the pain woke me up. What actually woke me up? I mean, I don't really know what woke me up. I know that I woke up and there was pain. What do you think is going on there?
I mean, I think there are probably cases and cases. So I guess that's maybe the bumper sticker for what I have to say about pain. There are cases and cases. Like, I think the main thing that would help us move forward is to stop trying to get one box that we can put them all in. So I think sometimes maybe what happens that wakes you up is that you really are in pain and the pain really does wake you up. I think that can be sometimes really what happens. Of course, you might think, well, what part of the pain, once we start getting fancy, is waking me up? And I think that, you know, might really differ. So, you know, it could be the negative affective bit that's waking you up. Something feels wrong. It could be there's some sort of damage has occurred, right? So if you pull a muscle or something, there could be some registration of damage that gets fed forward and disrupts, you know, whatever kind of sleep cycle or activity is happening. So I think, it could vary what's happening. But I definitely want to leave space for the idea that it is just exactly what we said is happening. The pain woke us up.
Yeah. Well, there is some scientific evidence around that in, you know, the on-off cells in the brainstem and they're kind of, you know, the off cells are on when you're asleep, but when you move then the on cells come on, and that sort of facilitates that kind of flow of information, which could then lead to prediction of pain. So there is biology that sort of, I guess, would feed that story or back it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so I'm not an expert on sleep. So it'd be interesting to hear more about how you think that might be working. But certainly when I think about what's normally identified as pain processing signals, and on those I am something of an expert, I'm really skeptical that any of those particular information channels are rightly thought of as being specific to pain. And so then I think no matter which, you know, sort of pathway you identify, we're going to still have a kind of open question about whether or not on that particular occasion, information being processed through that channel is sufficient for pain or something that we want to call pain. So I think it can be a bit tricky. So you could still have room for somebody to say, no, still it's not pain until you woke up and experienced it. It was just that bit of information flowing through, if you like. And that, to be fair, I think somebody could say something like that, about those cases. It would be hard to settle.
Yeah. So, you know, it sounds like we're kind of agreeing on, you know, that information flow is not pain. Pain is an experience. Exactly. And I think people often bring the two together or kind of muddy them up. But I know in the book you go into, you know, there's a good sort of section or sections on different classic models that have been put forward. Obviously Melzack and Wall and Price and whatnot, and kind of dissecting that and looking at that. But I guess people have traditionally looked for specific pathways that deal with pain, and still in the main press, even top journals of pain, you still see things like pain signals, pain messages, pain centers. I always have a problem with that because as far as I know, there are none of those things.
That's right. Yeah. No, I really appreciate that. So we're in strong agreement about that. I think it's just so unintuitive for people still. I think people still just really think there must be something in the body that correlates well with pain as reported. I think there just continue to look for it. And even if, some people are willing to give up at least the pain pathway idea, and then some people are willing to give up the pain center idea, and they still want to hold on to things that I think also are holding us back from better treatment. So things like, you know, even markers of pain or biomarkers that people are still looking for, or, you know, people are still trying to do, various kinds of fancy neural imaging to try to find, patterns and things. And I just think, even the thing you said before, that all pain is an experience and, you know, it's not going to be realized by any particular pathway. Even that, I think, is too simple. So this is my radical. I don't even think pain is just a certain kind of experience. I think, just to get a positive view on the table, I think we have this idea of pain that we use in everyday life, and it's just really promiscuous. So promiscuous is what I've started to call it, because for various reasons, I think that's the positive way to put what it is. So it allows many different types of things to be happening, you know, of roughly similar kind, or what philosophers sometimes call a family resemblance, or right, there's a group of characteristics that it might have, but that group of characteristics isn't a group of mechanistic characteristics. It's not like what we're picking out in everyday life are particular mechanisms. We're picking out things like, normally pain feels bad, normally I'm aware of it, normally something's wrong in my body when it happens, normally it motivates me to do something, normally it distracts me and captures my attention. But of course, we really have something like normally built in there, and we really do let all of those different things get in. And so once we start trying to do a science of pain, or start to do interventions for pain, I think it's really important to remember that this thing that we've picked out, you know, may not map on very well to any particular mechanism. That's like an open scientific question. And then I think now that we've done some of the science, it turns out it doesn't. And so we got to kind of let that go. It turns out our everyday idea, I think, is kind of a motley crew, promiscuous motley crew, you know. So in each particular patient's case, you got to figure out, well, what's going on with them? What's going on with you? Is it this pathway? Is it this mechanism? Is it this mental state? Is it this psychological thing? Is it this social thing? You know, it could be lots of things that need to be targeted to help alleviate the pain.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess what you're talking about there are these particular conditions, all of those things you mentioned, and probably a bunch of other stuff, that necessarily would only create the experience of pain. Now, that's kind of a Buddhist sort of philosophical standpoint, that the experience you're having right now is the only one you could have because the conditions are such, but they're unique to you and unique to this moment, which in the next moment could be completely different.
That's right. I think there's something about the radical idiosyncrasy of pain that we're still learning to appreciate.
And by that radical idiosyncrasy, do you mean this sort of changeability, the promiscuity that you've just described there?
I think really your particular pain is really particular, you know, it's easy. Of course, that doesn't mean we don't try to get the best generalizations that we can. And of course, you learn your body. So you know, like, oh, these sorts of foods make me feel icky. Just take like a non-pain case. There's all sorts of things that we're kind of idiosyncratic about that are particular to us. We understand that there's a lot of commonalities between people, but like, what makes you the special snowflake you are is how all those little different bits, you know, converge at any given time in any given person, in any given place. And so every moment in that sense is, every moment of every person is indeed kind of distinct, right? Even though we can find things that it has in common, you know, across people. And then if you think about a pain as being something happening for the person, not always even involving, I think, conscious experience, but something that's happening for the person. And we've picked it out as, you know, usually being a thing that feels bad, a thing that usually does all the things we talked about before. But then in that particular case, any one of those things might be missing. Any one of those things might change from moment to moment. And so we just have to be, I think, open and flexible. And, you know, that's not like, you know, don't want to sound more radical than I am. It's quite radical enough. You know, it's not like a cold or even cancer or, right. So some things, the generalizations, I think, do support some of our ways of picking things out are quite well tied to mechanisms.
Yeah.
Or are quite well tied to particular processes or, you know, genetic markers and things. So it's not as if, even though they also have particular manifestations, so they're going to look slightly different for each case. Pain, I think, is radically idiosyncratic, right? It's really promiscuous in a way that some of these other things are not. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, so, you know, I mean, use cancer as an example. Someone has a type of cancer, they'll often get, you know, similar kinds of treatments to the next person who has that, although their actual lived experience is completely different.
Exactly. So we have to, we always have to tailor treatments, right? I think that's just part of medicine, right? You've got to always tailor treatments to the particular individual. The question here is about whether the thing I'm diagnosing you with is itself an appropriate treatment target, And I think we've just assumed that for pain it is. And I think it turns out that it's not.
Yeah.
Which is a big surprise. And I think it's hard for us to grapple with. And our grappling with it, I think, is part of why our treatment continues to be, you know, inadequate in lots of cases. You know, we just struggle.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of issues around, you know, diagnosis, labels, how people feel about labels, you know, classically things like, you know, fibromyalgia. There's a lot of similarities, you probably know, between chronic pain and functional neurological disorder, so FND. I mean, I keep a foot in yep. both of those camps, unsurprisingly. And, you know, some people get very upset by the label because of the implications and then what they find out, because people have then written stuff about their experiences and whatnot, and they go, oh no, this is, you know, that's going to be my destiny. Or other people just hate the terminology. Someone yesterday was clearly very upset with the word functional in FND. And it just seems so important that we actually listen to them, because we need to make things better. We're trying to ease suffering here, make lives better. And this seems to be part of it. You know, when's a label useful, when isn't it? What are your thoughts on kind of labels and diagnoses?
Oh boy. I mean, you are probably better placed to speak to that than I am. I think I've thought a lot more about what will help for generalizations for science and particular medical interventions. But I tend to think, I mean, one thing to say, and then I would be curious to know what you think. I mean, I tend to think of a good clinician, so anyone who's at the interface with the patient and has a sort of expertise that they're bringing to bear to help the patient, to work together with the patient to identify the right way forward. I feel like that person is something like a translator, or somebody who's sort of genuinely standing at the interface between the patient's way of conceptualizing the world and themselves and understanding what's happening, and then all this sort of theoretical, all these theoretical tools and specialized ways of seeing the world and understanding the world that the clinician is bringing to bear. And the goal there is to be able to find a match, I think. You know, you're looking to find a kind of fit. And sometimes that's really tricky. But that's, as far as the labeling issue, anything that I'm an expert about, it's, I guess, something like that. You know, you have, and I talk about that a bit at the end of the book, you have this word pain that we use in everyday life. And what I'm suggesting is that word should drop out of the specialized scientific vocabulary. But where does that leave the doctor? So at the end of the book, then I have to address that, right? Well, it's all fine and good to say pain is no good for science, but it is good for everyday life. And then what does that mean when someone in pain needs help from medicine that we want to be, you know, based in science? And I think what it means is the doctor has to work as something like a translator between this everyday way of speaking. And you have to listen, just as you say, right? It's crucial. Listen to the person talking about their pain to figure out which thing in their situation is an appropriate target for treatment, right? Matches well one of these things that we do have good scientific generalizations about, and that we do have interventions which target directly. And, you know, so I think, yeah, I think that's a bit tricky. But I would have thought a good medical practitioner knows that they're doing something like translating, right? Like they're trying to get a fit between the models they have and the words that they're hearing.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess one of the issues there, I mean, I love the way you describe that and the language you use, you know, bringing to bear and that translation, that really kind of resonates. And you kind of highlighted the doctor as, and they're often the first person, aren't they? Not always, but the first person that's seen. I think one of the issues there, and this is a practical one, is the simple fact that not just doctors, but healthcare professionals do not receive in-depth training and education on pain, which seems utterly crazy when it's arguably one of the most significant or common reasons why people would actually seek help in the first place. But yet the amount and level and depth is it's really, really low. And I've never understood why. I mean, I was lucky that I had someone and so got into it. But that was pure luck. If I hadn't have been in that place at that time, I'm sure I wouldn't be doing this, which is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is that that's getting better, but I think still it's just still a problem. But part of the trouble is, what would you teach them in a way? There's not agreement about this, right? So I think it's quite tricky. Everyone wants to kind of wheel in the IASB definition or something, and we say, oh, look, let's all recognize that, you know, the expert on their pain, and we want to, you know, take them seriously and then report. But then we just kind of go on doing exactly what we did before, you know.
Yeah.
Where it was. And that's because, and I think I don't know, I sometimes feel like I'm over here like gesturing around about it, but I think we should just let it stay in our everyday vocabulary and get better at listening and understanding what the person is saying is really going on to find some other treatment targets. I just think, you know, it feels to me like I have children. Do you have children,
Mishma? Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So I'm American. So when my children are hurt, I call it an owie. I say, oh, you have an owie. It feels a bit to me like, you know, we want to keep owie as a scientific term or something a little bit. Like my daughter really, she fell the other day and really scraped her knee, and she really had an owie. Right? It would be silly to say no owie. She definitely has an owie. I'm not trying to say there's no owies, but it would also be really weird if I was like then looking for the owie treatment. It's like, well what is the owie?
Yeah.
This is a way of carving up space that's just not yet suitable for knowing what action to take. I've got to look at the owie, listen to her tell me about the owie, and figure out, you know, does she need Savlon on it? Does she need a plaster? Does she just need me to kiss it and make it better? Does she just need a cuddle? You know, like different owies need different mommy interventions. So I feel it feels to me really similar on the pain side. So in a way, I think it's not, from my perspective, I think in a way, when we say things like people need better pain education, it's almost hits my ears like people need better owie education. Like that's not quite right. People need to get better at learning how to listen to their patients, tell them about their owies. That's definitely true. Owies are real, and you know, pain is real, and it's a real problem to be addressed. But I think a lot of the issues we have with people feeling like they're being told the pain is just in their mind, or it's not real, or is because we have this idea of pain as something, even though we know it doesn't really work, as something physical in the body with specialized something that we can identify and see and target. And it just isn't that, I think. We've just learned it isn't that. But as soon as it's just clearly not that, then people say, are you saying my pain isn't real? All of that. You're thinking about the pain being cast to go, any particular pain might involve a range of biological, psychological, social, you know, cognitive, evaluative, motivational systems, mechanisms that are appropriate, you know, targets for treatment in that particular person's case. And all of those are real and important.
Yeah, because, you know, like any experience, and we could talk about hunger, we could talk about love. I think, you know, these are things that we all feel. No one really debates that, do they? If you say, oh, look, I'm really in love with this person, people go, not sure. I think it's in your head. You know, and these are all embodied experiences, because, you know, I'm not going to feel love over there. I'm going to feel it here with the very fact that it's me, with all of my stuff and the particular body I have and past experiences. So, you know, these things, the, you know, pain and thirst and hunger and all the rest of it, need all kind of non-pain, non-thirst stuff to create that. Or it could be a cake, you know, to have a cake, you've got to have all non-cake stuff that comes together in a particular way. Otherwise, it's not really a cake.
Yeah, I think it's a really hard question which things are actually part of pain and which things are required for pain, or the non-pain stuff that's giving you the pain. And I think I have become convinced that oftentimes a lot of things that are getting counted as non-pain are actually part of the pain. And that this thing that everyone thinks all the pains definitely have, and the rest is just this like particular way it feels, this particular kind of experience that's maybe embodied, that maybe changes the landscape of affordances, that maybe motivates me, that maybe is typically but not always correlated with damage, that but really what it is this particular feeling, and all that other stuff is just around it. I think that's what I've sometimes called the orthodoxy of simplicity. So ultimately, pain is just this particular feeling, embodied, complicated relationships, but really ultimately, and I think that is still the last vestige of this oversimplification that if we could somehow free ourselves of, I think we would open up and make some progress in areas that we're sort of still stuck in, you know, dualisms between the mind and the body, and thinking wider and more, you know, tailored to the particular person about what might be going on, if we could get rid of, I think, even that last simplifying step, I think it would help us out. You know, it's really hard, I think, to let go of. And I should say, I don't know about some of these other cases, you know, so we should really go case by case. So if you think, you know, we've developed as a people, you know, ways of seeing and explaining the world to get along and survive, some of the ways that we've carved things up may turn out to be really closely tied to mechanisms, and some may not. So, you know, hunger or thirst may well turn out to be really well correlated with particular systems in the body. It sure looks like thirst, for instance, is pretty, of course, it can be modulated, as you say, by these external things, but you may be able to pick out a core there that really is well tied to a particular system or a mechanism, and others may not. So I'm not a expert on love. I think it's like an open question whether love turns out to be, so far as I know, whether love turns out to be, you know, correlated or tied to or usefully picked out for a lot of our scientific or psychological, you know, specialized theories as being tied in a certain way to some particular system in the body. Or a particular type of experience. I'm not an expert on love. Love seems like a many splendored thing too, like pain, but I'm not sure, like maybe it would turn out, right? So I just think we need to actually follow the science where it leads us. And with pain, you know, we've been trying to figure pain out for, you know, forever. Yeah. So we've got a lot of science to look at, right? And I think it's the science that really shows us this radical thing. I think that actually this thing that we've picked out in our everyday life is just very promiscuous.
It brings up the uncertainty, which a lot of people seem to be quite uncomfortable with. They, you know, they want to know for sure, but the reality is there's so much that we don't know, and it seems that part of the stuckness is such desire for certainty that people hang on to, you know, the simplicity that you described, because letting go of that seems so scary, because it means, well, if that's not true, then gee, what? I don't know if that's what sort of underpins, but it certainly seems that the stuckness with a pain experience, not that it's the same, but just, you know, repeated episodes of pain that we could call chronic pain, part of that stuckness is this sort of stuckness or rigidity of beliefs about, no, it's caused by this. There's definitely a thing there. And until they release that or update that belief, it just, they have similar experiences over and over.
Yeah. And I think people could, it's understandable, right? Given the working model that we've sort of pushed for so long in science, even if we just say, even if we give lip service to the IASP stuff, you know, which has its own problems, we could talk about that if you want, but, you know, for so long, people now have thought, yes, pain is the result of some damage to my body being registered, and then that feels a certain way. And that sort of basic thing is very hard to get rid of. And it gives people hope in a way that we don't yet have good alternatives for. You know, we're working on it, but, you know, we don't have as clear path forward. If it's not that, then, you know, the way, as you say, is really uncertain and scary. And so, you know, it's easier to try to hang on to that and make that stick, make that story stick, even though that story is no good, even for a paper cut, you know? So it's hard. I think that part's really hard. And we've just, you know, some, again, I think, you know, progress is happening. So, you know, which you will know better than I do probably, but like, if you think about, you know, pain clinics and the rise of the pain clinic and individually tailored treatments, you know, where we're seeing better progress, you know, I think we're learning. You want to kind of, as I might try to put it, you know, like get under the pain language. So the person comes in and they've got chronic pain, and that yet doesn't tell you anything, right, about what we need to do. So that's not a treatment target, right? It doesn't yet tell you the mechanism that needs to be targeted. Many things might be going on there. So then we need to get under that and figure out and help, you know, the person who's suffering the chronic pain, real thing, just like an owie, it's a real thing, get under it and figure out, you know, what's really going on. And my whole beef, I guess, like the thing I'm running around trying to convince people of is once we get under it, we don't find the pain system or the pain mechanism, or that's the talk I wish we could sort of, give up on that. Because once we focus in on what is there, I think we might make more progress there.
Yeah. It feels like, you know, some of that, what you're describing there will come through in a compassionate conversation where mainly they're talking about their experiences, but then turning it towards, well, you know, what matters to you in your life? You know, what do you really value? And has that connection, has that connection with that kind of dropped away? So it might be doing certain things, being with certain people. You know, really disengaging because they're essentially, and I know you've discussed the idea of protection, which was interesting, but they're kind of protecting themselves, surviving, getting by as best they can. They're doing the best that they can with what they have. But kind of really, really stuck with that. So they kind of know what they want to do, because I love going for walks. I love this. I love that. And they know why it matters, because I like to exercise, I like to be with people, do that. They just don't know how. And it just seems that the how, not the only target, if we want to call it, for what we do, but seems to be a really big one. Because as soon as people start re-engaging with what matters, and often they think they can't because they might have been told certain things, even as simple as music. I mean, I'm a real music sort of person. I love music. So I quite often will talk to people about what music they like for various reasons. It often relaxes them. Most people do like music, but it's amazing how many people don't listen to music anymore. they don't listen to music anymore. Sometimes there's reasons why. It might be too much, you know, if they're very sensitive. But you're like, well, why don't you start listening to a little bit of music, really? And then you're explaining, well, that's actually one of the many skills and strategies you can use to improve your life. Because if you're listening to music and you feel better, you've changed your state, you've changed your biology, you've changed your experience. Surely that's better than not.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other things around that. So it just seems that that might be a good target.
Yeah. So it's interesting what you say. It brings up a lot of stuff. So perhaps especially given the context we're in right now, it's useful to maybe distinguish something I think is important to distinguish is between pain and suffering. So, you know, a lot of times we lump those together, sort of like in legal practices and certainly historically and also in philosophy and ethics, they get lumped together quite a lot. And it's been really surprising to me to see just how little, I mean, if you think there's only, you know, if you think there's insufficient stuff on pain, oh golly, there's hardly anything on suffering comparatively, like what exactly it is, how we should think about it, its role in medicine. And, you know, Eric Cassell wrote this very famous paper called Suffering, the Goals of Medicine in the 80s, which everyone should read, I think. And that really inspired me to start doing some thinking about suffering and what it is and how it's different. And on my view, you know, I've got some other work on this. I think suffering is about agency. So in just the way that you were talking about, you're thinking about, look, we want to think about what the person does and how to enable them or make them come to a place of being empowered to do things and live in a certain way. And that's really why chronic pain can be so terrible, of course, right, is because it undermines or disrupts, is how I like to put it, your agency, right? And pain is not the only thing that does that. So if you think about the other things from which we suffer, you know, we suffer from pain sometimes. Sometimes we don't suffer from pain. Sometimes it's no big deal, right? But when we do suffer from pain, And it's the same as when we suffer from, I think, addiction or fear or depression, right? What is it to suffer, I think, is for our agency to be significantly disrupted. And so if something like that is right, then what you're talking about, I think, fits really nicely into that and thinking about what can I do to enrich this person's agency? That's what relief suffering is, enriching agency. And, you know, get helping someone to be able to do the things that they do in the way that they want to do them for the goods that they want from them. And I think that in an environment, you know, you've got to think about the environment so that they can act. You've got to think about their goals in acting. You've got to think about their capacities in acting. That's all to do with agency and enriching agency. And I definitely think that really what we're trying to do in addressing chronic pain is actually to relieve the suffering, right? Yeah. And what does that mean? On my view, what that means is we're trying to address this disruption to their agency, right? And how do we do it? Well, we want to find ways to enrich their agency. And I think, you know, listening to music is a way we can do that. You know, help them figure out what are the things that are most important to you? What do you want to be able to do? Why do you want to be able to do those things, right? That's all a conversation about how to enrich agency. And sometimes it has nothing to do with pain, and certainly it's often done without taking pain as a treatment target, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems that, and I often say this to people I work with at the right time, that, you know, the more the focus is on your pain and the bit that hurts or the bits that hurt, the worse the outcomes, because it's like, don't think of elephants. You just, the whole focus is on it. The more you focus on the type of life you want to live, and the steps to take now in that direction, realizing you're not there yet, and this is a process, you know, this is a journey, you know, practice or that skill you're doing now is not the end result. This is something that you work on with new habits and patterns and such like, the better the outcomes. And that's not ignoring the fact that there's pain. You need skills and strategies to deal with those moments where pain is there and it is impacting on you. I mean, if it's not, then you're kind of carrying on anyway. But if it is impacting, you need skills to deal with those difficult moments. And there are plenty of things that you can do around that. But if the main focus is that, right, I'm working towards, you know, getting fitter, getting stronger, leading a healthier life, that's where I'm going. And these are the things I do each day. It just seems that you're watering the right seeds then and putting your focus on what you want rather than what you don't want.
Exactly. Yeah. Or as I would put it, thinking about ways I can enrich my agency or adapt to this disruption to my agency over here. Right. So I have this thing that's undermining my ability to be and act in the world in ways that satisfy my values and my expectations, right? That's why it's such a problem. What do I do? Well, I've got to change something if I can, right? Something has to change either in my environment so I can do things, or in my abilities, I've got to develop new things to do. I've got to start doing new things, or in my goals, but something to do, I think, with my what I'm doing and how I'm doing it and why I'm doing it and where I'm doing it. Those are the ways to, I think, alleviate the suffering. And it's true, again, I say, I think if that's right, and I guess I do think it's right, I mean, I'm on record as thinking it's right, then that's, I think, going to work. If it works, it's going to work not just for pain. I think that can be sort of reinforcing too of what we're doing here. You know, a similar thing is true, I think, for addiction or for depression or for any of these fear, you know, paralyzing fear, any of these things that can, that are disrupting our agency. The response, I've done a lot of work lately with thinking about end of life in this sort of context. You know, here's this thing that's disrupting my agency, and when maybe it's not going away, right? Yeah. But that, I said, then what do I do? Well, I think then about all my forms of agency, the range of actions I have, and what's most important to me, what it will mean to succeed in those ways, and figure out how to enrich my agency in the light of this suffering, this thing that's undermining my agency. And I think that's true, you know, as I say, for chronic pain, but also for any of these other forms of suffering, they have that in common.
Yeah, you're right. The discussion around suffering doesn't seem to happen as much. Am I right in thinking that you know, with Cassell, and I read that paper a long time ago and kind of got into some of the stuff around suffering, but this kind of loss of sense of self, obviously there's a lot of debate around what self actually is and whether it actually exists and all that stuff. So it kind of opens a whole can of worms. But this loss of who you think you are or who you should be or who you were and all that.
Yeah, so Cassell talks about threats to the intactness of a person. And I think One nice thing about that is it's very broad. One difficult thing about it is it's very broad. So what counts as a threat versus a challenge? Which things concern my intactness as a person? Are there unified persons? As you say, I think it can be, it can just be suddenly hard to work with. But I think the insight from Cassell, and I think what's great about even that early paper, is to work, the work he does to distinguish pain, even though I don't agree with what he says about pain, but the work to distinguish pain from suffering and to sort of try to get clear a little bit in our minds about those things being different, I think, and to recognize the role of suffering as often being the thing that actually is important in the treatment context. I think that's really helpful. Because you might think, oh no, look, my goal is to get rid of the pain. And of course, if pain isn't really an appropriate treatment target, which is the thing, you know, I've spent 10 years banging on about, then if that's right, well, then what is, right? What are we doing? What do we do?
Yeah.
One thing we do is, I think, figure out which mechanisms are at play that are converging to give rise to the pain or to contribute to that particular radically idiosyncratic pain. Another thing we do is look at the way that the pain, the very promiscuous thing that it is, the way that pain is causing the person to suffer, and we look for ways to alleviate suffering. And it, on my view, what that means is looking for ways to enrich their agency in response to this disruption.
I guess that people generally don't necessarily make that connection, and that's why if you as a clinician would say, well, we're going to really, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily say it like this, but we're really going to focus on easing your suffering. And through doing that, your pain is going to change in hopefully some sort of positive way. You know, a lot of people probably don't want to hear that. They want, no, I want my pain to go. And I totally get that. But it's all, again, hinges on these belief systems, doesn't it, about what pain is, which then speaks of the importance of that first step is helping people to understand their experiences of pain. I can't see how people can progress in the way that they can, you know, open their doors of opportunity without really having some understanding of where we are with this stuff.
I totally agree with you. And I want to be careful here. So maybe just to reiterate, I think both of those things are an important part, certainly for chronic pain, as I understand it, are an important part of the treatment context. So you want to think, try to, as I put it at one point, get under the pain language, really listen to the patient and figure out what's going on with their pain. Their pain is real, but it may have a wide range of mechanistic explanations, which are converging in an idiosyncratic way in their particular case. And the first step is to figure out that picture. But then it's also part of the treatment context. And that's the thing I wanted to kind of take from Cassell, and that your music example made me think of, you know, is to address the suffering. And those aren't always the same thing, of course. Here's the pain, and here's the suffering caused by the pain. And you want to figure out, you know, what's happening with the pain thing and figure out if anything is an appropriate target for treatment there. And then you want to figure out, you know, how to help the person suffer less from the pain. Mm-hmm. And those goals, I think, are both appropriately on the table. The thing that I think is getting in our way of addressing those is taking the pain itself to be the treatment target.
Yeah.
And I just, pain is never that. It's never that post-surgically. It's never that with a paper cut. It's never that with a headache. It's never that with chronic pain. Because as it turns out, pain is this thing we've picked out that is radically promiscuous when it comes to mechanisms. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and maybe something that helps people to understand that is, I mean, I often say, look, you know, the tissues of your body, so where you're feeling your pain, those tissues don't have the ability to generate that experience. Yes, you're feeling it there. It's absolutely real, but it's being generated by your body systems top down. I sort of come through the predictive processing lens more than probably other things, which seems to be providing some good explanations. Obviously, we're not there yet, and there's a lot more work to be done for sure, but it seems to be a really good place to be in now, because if you say, well, I've got back pain, yes, it hurts, and it's, you know, the location is in your back, but your back is not generating that experience. Okay. It's my disc, it's a classic, isn't it, my disc is this or that. Okay. Yeah. so where in the disc is the pain coming from? Well, it's coming from the herniated bit there. You can see that on the scan. Okay. Well, where in that bit of herniation is the pain. Well, it's going to be in the materials there, and there's chemicals. Okay, well, where in those chemicals is the pain coming from? Well, in the chemical, you've got these cells, and well, where? It just goes on and on. And of course, there's no answer, which really sort of speaks of what you're saying there, that there is nothing there to treat. There is no target there, which to a lot of people sounds really radical. And I hope people aren't switching off now. Stick with it. because this is really important stuff. You know, this seems to be the reality. There is nothing there. But obviously putting hands on, moving stuff, you know, does sometimes help, but probably not for the reasons people think they do.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is often a treatment target. It's just never the pain. So, and it's not the pain, as you say, in that case, in the classic herniated disc case, it's not the case in a paper cut either, as I was saying before, or in a headache. You know, we have these things, we call them painkillers. We all know that there's no thing in the body, pain, that those things are targeting, right? Opioids.
Despite the advert that shows it going round to that point.
Exactly. That's what I mean, right? These sort of things feed these, I think, pernicious ideas that there is this thing in your body, pain. And that's true, I think, a lot of, you know, predictive processing models commit a similar mistake. They needn't. But they commit a similar mistake if they say, here's this thing that gets generated, pain, where again, what we've done is created this thing that now we're going to try to get a neurological picture of it, even if whether it's top down or bottom up. Oh, there's this one particular thing that is the pain, and we're still trying to get a story of it. So whether that thing is being, whether the model gives it to you from the bottom up through nociceptors, or whether it gives it to you from the top down through some sort of prefrontal predictive process, that's a myth, I think, that we need to release. Mm-hmm. And if we can just say, think of it like an owie or some other, you know, one last analogy, maybe if you think of some kind of very broad, promiscuous kind of experience, like going to the museum, I think is an example I use in the book. There are lots of different things that might be involved in going to the museum. Of course, it's a real thing. Going to the museum.
Yeah.
I love going to the museum. So it's a real thing going to the museum. When I'm stressed, I walk up and spend 10 minutes looking at the old pretty things. And I might see very different things when I go to the museum. When one goes to the museum, you might go to very different places. You might be nice sometimes. It might be not nice sometimes. It might be inspiring sometimes. It might be boring sometimes. There is still a real thing going to the museum, but it would be really strange to think about a going to the museum mechanism or a going to the museum system because it's such a promiscuous thing, right?
Yeah.
So I think if we can just really start appreciating just how radically idiosyncratic and promiscuous pain is, it will open up our range of treatment options. And if you just think of the history of pain, whenever we broaden, we get better, you know?
Yeah.
Whenever we allow more to be included as being the source of the trouble, you know, it's this way we have this very broad term that's very useful for us in everyday life of going, whoa, something is wrong and I need help. It's useful for that. Mm. But it's not a treatment target, not a particular one. It doesn't yet tell you what to do. Wall said it a long time ago and then I piped down, that the pain report was an invitation to seek a treatment target. And I have always thought that was really lovely, right? As far as thinking about how much and how little it tells you about what action to take in response. You know, it's an invitation to figure out what's going on, but it hasn't yet told you what's going on.
Yeah, that's like, yeah, that is, yeah, the invitation or gentle sort of tap on the door that then hopefully is open to explore and to understand, you know, and you mentioned this sort of earlier on, you know, with you're doing it together as the clinician, the therapist, the person. I always hesitate to use the word patient, but sometimes you have to. So people, well, I say person, but sometimes you have to say patient. Otherwise, people think you're just talking about someone random. But so when I'm writing, I often write person and in brackets, AKA patient.
It does sound very passive, doesn't it? It would be nice to have it makes it sound like they're just taking it or something.
Well, yeah, and that's a big problem, isn't it? Because it sort of feeds the idea of being fixed of being, you know, this passenger rather than being enabled and empowered right from the beginning, which I wholly believe in. You know, these people are autonomous. They're going to make their own decisions based on their own beliefs. And that's why something like motivation interviewing as a way of being, I think, is an incredibly powerful approach, very humanistic, obviously based with Carl Rogers, and enables you to really be with someone and to step into their shoes, but also to step out, but to have these compassionate conversations about change. I'm totally convinced by that.
Yeah, so I am not an expert on the MI stuff. I only know a very little bit about it, but boy, if I had more time, it would be great to be able to take a deeper dive. But it sounds like you really find it useful. I mean,
well, you just used it.
Without realizing it. Oh, good. I'm glad.
Some people do, you know, a lot of people do. They're very skilled at it. I think, as you know, clinicians and therapists often want, tell us how to do it. You know, give us these skills, give us the formula, whether we can just then bang out to everyone. But it's, of course, it's not that at all. It's just a wonderful way of being with people, and not just people you're working with, you know, people. It's, you know, if you ever went and did the training with someone like Steve Rolnick and Orla Adams, who I've come to know, it's an amazing couple of days. It's not like a course, it so isn't. It's just this immersive experience of humanity and just coming at it from different ways in a very sort of safe, open space. I mean, it's a great, if you have to communicate with people, which of course is basically everyone, I would always suggest, encourage people to go and spend a couple of days on this.
Well, there you go. You've encouraged me. I will at least follow up and check it out. Like I said, I've heard a little bit about it, but I've never like taken a deep dive and had a look. But certainly the bit I know, as far as taking the time up front to listen to people and focus on their way of talking and identifying ways of making changes that are coming from them, that all seems exactly right to me, and really connected to some of the other stuff I've been doing with suffering, as hopefully was clear talking about agency and things. That seems like where it's at. I'm not part of it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's something that sort of shines through of all the stuff you're saying, and that is the fact that, well, obviously there's a lot more work to be done, and that's great. But you know, it's giving a lot of hope to people. You know, the fact that some, you know, you're working on it and other people are working on it. But yeah, there's definite optimism coming through that we're going in a good direction here to help people. That's the bottom line, is that we want people to ease their suffering, by having better lives.
Yeah, that's right. I you're on the ground, as it were, so you might have a different, more pessimistic stance, but I definitely think that things are improving, that we're moving in the right direction. I think there's more, you know, there's issues of resourcing, as there always is, but I think there's certainly more of a recognition that, at least for pain, that we have to listen to the individual in order to identify what's going on and tailor the treatment to them. And for me, that's already a big step in the right direction, that's taken a long time to get there. And it's partly connected, I think, to the breakdown of some of these dichotomies we've had between the body and the mind. I think that's really helped, actually, relinquishing commitment to the idea that if something's wrong, I can point to where it's wrong, in the way you were talking about before, and understanding that things are more complicated than that, and that people are more variable than we, you know, might have thought, and the role that different mechanisms are playing, either in the constitution, like actually as part of the thing, or in the modulation of a malady that they're seeking help for. I think those sort of little, maybe seemingly little things by themselves, really have come together, I think, to help us, you know, make some progress. I do think things are moving in the right direction, even if I'm still further down the radical road, waving my hands, going, just stop taking it as a treatment target altogether. Stop talking about pain science and pain medicine and pain pathways and pain centers and pain protocols, you know. I can still be shouting down there and see that there's progress, even if we still have it in ways that I wish we didn't.
Well, I think actually I'm with you on that. You know, it sounds
amazing.
It really resonates. You know, but you know, as you probably read and heard, you know, Pat Wall, I can't remember the exact wording, but you know, around the fact that it's extremely difficult to replace an existing simple model with something that's far more complex.
Yep.
But I always say, well, hold on a minute. Okay, I get that, because this is far more complex. This takes a lot more thought. It takes looking at lots of different things to get a grip on it. And that's why, you know, studying pain takes years to get a grip on it. You can't learn it in a weekend course. But through that complexity comes so much opportunity. You know, who would have thought that you could talk about, you know, music for someone as a way of improving their life, or walking the dog, or their partner stroking them in a particular way, or a million other things that they could be doing to improve their life. So improving their life by doing the things that they love doing rather than focusing on treating pain, which seems to be kind of what you're saying in some ways, if I'm getting it right.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I want to make sure that we keep both steps in view. So again, a lot of what you were just saying seems to me to be focusing on the suffering aspect. And I think that is really important, and that's huge progress that we take that seriously in the treatment context as a goal of medicine, as Cassell would have put it. But also on the pain front, sometimes there is a particular mechanistic activity that's the right target for treatment. So we want to make sure, I think, to, you know, due diligence there. And that's, I think that's the thing that Wall was, I'm sure, very hip to understanding was a hard sell, right? You say, I thought there was this one mechanism or one system. And you're telling me that when a person reports pain, I have to figure out what of a range of mechanisms or systems might be the appropriate treatment target. And then it might turn out none of those work, and I have to focus on suffering. So I think, you know, that is still a kind of hard sell. But I think the success, when we buy that, or at least the more we buy it, the more success we have. I'm still down here trying to get us further. Yeah. The more we buy that, the more success we have. That, I think, is what's winning the day, right? Mm. I think. Because you've made progress this way, right? Like, why did the gate control theory, which is still not all the way down the road, as you see I say in my book, but why did it eventually get uptake? I think it was the TENS machine stuff, right? Like, it was, you were getting results from low level stimulation. That's why. It was all fine and good to have all the theory and have all the negative arguments against the simple models, but nobody started picking up the new stuff until you got success with this alternative intervention, right? So it's showing that it works is what's gonna win, you know.
I mean, that's such an important point, isn't it, that we almost could sort of just move on from, but I think pausing on it, the fact, and again, you know, Wall said this, didn't he, the fact that, you know, all this stuff has got to make sense to the person who's experiencing pain. It's got to make a difference there, otherwise what's the point? And they need to have some understanding of that.
That's right.
So that's our role, isn't it? That's to distill this stuff into something that's practical and useful. But as you say, you know, sometimes there are some clear-ish mechanisms. You know, someone who has perhaps an inflammatory condition that needs some kind of specific medication or treatments that are known to really help with that. Great. Yeah, absolutely. But they also need the skills to live and grow and develop their life and what they're doing and engaging with as well. And that seems to be a big part of the work. You know, taking a pill, that takes a moment. But how do I live? How do I do this thing? Well, what's the best way of doing that? So that's a...
Yep. You want to both identify any particular mechanistic activity that might be part of the idiosyncratic convergence that is underlying that particular pain. And then you want to look for opportunities and needs to enrich agency to decrease the suffering. I think those are the two kind of, and both of those things are important and need to be done. And it only can happen effectively if you think of, you know, the clinician as standing between the everyday person and their way of understanding their world and their experience, and this whole raft of specialized inquiries and treatment options that you have, and you've got to, you know, work at that interface to identify the mechanisms and eliminate the suffering or reduce the suffering.
The translator. Yeah. Wow. No, this has been fascinating. Maybe we'll have to do a part two and three and whatnot. But I'm just going to show for people who are watching. But I'll put all the links and stuff on the show page, as it's called. But where can people find out about your work? Obviously, I can read the book, but where else can they see what you're up to and follow your work?
I'm a senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Glasgow. So if you Google my name and the University of Glasgow, you'll find my stuff there.
Okay.
And my email address too. Anyone can get in touch.
All right, cool.
And what too is there.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, I'll put all those things there so people can check it out. But look, that's been a brilliant chat. Thanks so much for sharing all of that.
Thanks, Fish, and I really appreciate you getting in touch.
No, not at all. But yeah, keep in touch, and we'll hopefully catch up again.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.